right, my friends. It's April 11th, 2007. I'm Scott Horton. Welcome to Anti-War Radio on Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Got a ton of news for you today. Tons of news. Some of it good news. Not most. Top story today. Actually, let me go ahead and give out the telephone number before I get to the top story. The phone number here is 646-6446, 646-6446, if anybody wants to get involved on the program and, discuss what's going on here. 646-6446. If you're from out of town, the area code is 512. Sorry, we don't have the 800 number yet. Soon. But if you're listening online from out of town, it's 512-646-6446. Feel free to go ahead and call in. Top story today from antiwar.com. There's a ton of stories competing for top story here, but I'm going to start with the Washington Post today. Three generals spurn the position of war czar. And, of course, czar, spelled T-S-A-R or C-Z-A-R, it means Caesar, right? Like Kaiser is German for Caesar. Czar is Russian for Caesar. And this is the kind of government that America doesn't have, one with a czar of any kind. Or do we? Oh, I'm sorry. We have a drug czar, and we have a Securities and Exchange Commission czar and a Homeland Security czar and who knows what kind of czars in America now. Completely contrary to our form of government. And maybe it's just a figure of speech. Maybe I take it too far, but I don't like the idea that we emulate cultures like Germany and Russia. After all, many of our ancestors fled places like that to come here and be free, not to have czars. That's supposed to be, I guess, it tests in the focus groups, right? We use the word czar for the focus group, and they felt like that meant that something was being taken care of. And so, you know, I don't know. Anyway, this is Peter Baker and Thomas E. Ricks from this morning's Washington Post. Page 1, three generals spurn the position of war czar. The White House wants to appoint a high-powered czar to oversee the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, with authority to issue directions to the Pentagon, the State Department, and other agencies. But it has had trouble finding anyone able and willing to take the job, according to people close to the situation. Apparently, there's no question as to whether this is constitutional, whether Congress would have to be involved in passing a law to create such a position or anything else. Apparently, it goes without saying at the Washington Post that it's perfectly within the president's authority to create a brand new office to take charge of departments created by Congress. Maybe that's so. Continuing here with the article, pardon me. At least three retired four-star generals approached by the White House in recent weeks have declined to be considered for the position, the sources said, underscoring the administration's difficulty in enlisting its top recruits to join the team after 5 years of warfare that have taxed the United States and its military. Now, how do you like that, guys? So George Bush says, I want a new position, the war czar, to oversee the State Department and the Pentagon, basically, to force those two agencies to, arrange their plans in Iraq together. There's a word I was searching for there that never came up. Anyway, so he's offered this job to three different retired four-star generals, and they've told him no. They've told him, forget it. Not me. Ask Bob. The very fundamental issue is they don't know where the hell they're going, said retired Marine General John J. Jack Sheehan, a former top NATO commander who was among those rejecting the job. Sheehan said he believes that Vice President Cheney and his hawkish allies remain more powerful within the administration than pragmatists looking for a way out of Iraq. Quote, so rather than go over there, develop an ulcer, and eventually leave, I said no thanks, he said. Wow, so it's not a silly conspiracy theory that the vice president is the one? That he and his cabal of neocon warmongers are the ones causing the problems in this administration? It's perfectly okay. I saw on MSNBC this morning, she said, wow, gee whiz. I guess if a four-star general says that about Dick Cheney, maybe it is true. Yeah. Seriously, I saw that. That was, I forget. I shouldn't unfairly accuse MSNBC. It might have been CNN or Fox. I forget which. I was flipping through the channels this morning, but that was what one of them said. Wow, a four-star general comes right out and says Vice President Cheney and his hawkish allies remain more powerful within the administration than pragmatists looking for a way out. So forget it. I'm not going to go work for Dick Cheney. Well, okay, so maybe Dick Cheney really is a problem. That's right. It's April 2007, and at least one little hairdo on cable news today allowed for the possibility that Cheney's influence inside the administration, perhaps is worthy of examination. The White House has not publicly disclosed its interest in creating the position, hoping to find someone President Bush can anoint and announce for the post all at once. Officials said they are still considering options for how to reorganize the White House's management of the two conflicts. If they cannot find a person suited for the sort of specially empowered office they envision, they said, they may have to retain the current structure. The administration's interest in the idea stems from long-standing concern over the coordination of civilian and military efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan by different parts of the U.S. government. The Defense and State Departments have long struggled over their roles and responsibilities in Iraq, with the White House often forced to referee. And, I was about to say it, but here they go in the post. The highest-ranking White House official responsible exclusively for the wars is Deputy National Security Advisor Megan O'Sullivan, who reports to National Security Advisor Stephen J. Hadley and does not have the power to issue orders to agencies. O'Sullivan plans to step down soon, giving the White House the opportunity to rethink how it organizes the war effort. Well, that's Stephen Hadley's job. He's the National Security Advisor. Condoleezza Rice was supposed to do this in the first administration and, of course, did not. In fact, I don't know what the hell she did as National Security Advisor other than go on TV and tell lies to you and your family to lie you into a war, to get your mom scared that, she's going to get nuked in her jammies in the middle of the night. Other than that, I don't know what the hell Condoleezza Rice did, because she surely did not coordinate policy between the State Department and the Defense Department, other than perhaps sometimes just doing the will of the Defense Department over the rest. But that's the president's job, and that's his national security advisor's job, right? To give orders to the to the Defense Department and the State Department. Is that not the job of the President of the United States to speak with Stephen Hadley and hear Hadley, the National Security Advisor, explain to him, well, Mr. Bush, the State Department is doing this, and they're pissed off because the Defense Department's doing that, and they wish that the Defense Department would be doing that. The Defense Department says this about the State Department, and herein lies the problem, so what do we do? And then George Bush, if he is indeed the president of the United States, is supposed to say to Stephen Hadley, you tell them that I said do X. That's it. The president is the war czar. Was there any doubt about it? That George Bush is the war czar in America? He needs another one? He doesn't have, he can't bring Condoleezza Rice and Robert Gates and bring them and put them in the same room and say, what the hell is the matter with you people? This is what I want to happen and I want you to do it now or you're fired. George Bush can't do that. The war czar, the emperor who, purely through the power of his belief is going to remake the world for the better with military force. Through sheer force of his will and superheated cluster bomb shrapnel. He can't coordinate between Gates and Rice? I got a perfect idea for the job. here's who you get. You got, I mean, hell, already, again, if you're just tuning in, the president wants to create a war czar to coordinate the State and Defense Departments and other agencies in the war efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I got the perfect candidate for the job. Don Rumsfeld. Right? Why not? He still works at the Pentagon. I know you thought that when Gates replaced him and he stepped down that he was gone, but no, he still has an office at the Pentagon, still has access to all the top secret data. And of course, you know, that's why Don Rumsfeld was a failure, because he wasn't the boss of Condoleezza Rice. He had to deal with her as an equal. And so things just didn't work out right. But, you know, if what Bush says is true, then Don Rumsfeld did a hell of a great job as the Secretary of Defense. And maybe the only problem is that he didn't have quite enough power and authority. Makes sense, right? I don't know. Maybe that's just me. But if you need a war czar, why not do it? These four-star generals won't do it. They refuse to do it. They don't want to go and you know, be stuck taking orders from Cheney and then get blamed for all of Cheney's mistakes and bad strategies. Here's this guy, Sheehan, who was a commander at NATO, who's a four-star general. Hang on, let me page up to the top and get his whole name for you. General, Marine General John J. Jack Sheehan. In an interview yesterday, Sheehan said that Hadley contacted him and they discussed the job for 2 weeks, but that he was dubious from the start. Quote, "I've never agreed on the basis of the war and I'm still skeptical," Sheehan said. "Not only did we not plan properly for the war, we grossly underestimated the effect of sanctions and Saddam Hussein on the Iraqi people." Blah, blah. There's the residue of the Cheney view. We're going to win. Al-Qaeda's there. That justifies anything we did, he said. And then there's the pragmatist view. How the hell do we get out of Dodge and survive? Unfortunately, the people with the former view are still in the position of most influence. Sheehan said he wrote a note March 27th declining interest. And at least two other four-star generals have also turned down the job as newly empowered, according to the Washington Post, war czar. Oh, and just a coincidence, I'm sorry, I'm paging down here. In the Washington Post from this morning, three generals spurned the position of war czar. The idea of someone, and tell me how predictable this was. The idea of someone overseeing the wars has been promoted to the White House by several outside advisors. It would be definitely a good idea, said Frederick W. Kagan, a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Hope they do it, and I hope they do it soon, and I hope they pick the right guy. It's a real problem. We don't have a single individual back here who is really capable of coordinating the effort. Man, that is insane. So Frederick Kagan, the guy that wrote up the surge plan over at the American Enterprise Institute, apparently he's one of the guys pushing for the creation of the new war czar. That's what we call a revolution within the form. That's how America becomes a fascist dictatorship, see? You let them, for example, blame the CIA for lying us into war, even though the CIA didn't. It was the liars at the Defense Department. But while the compliant media goes along with that story, you use all that righteous indignation and outrage at the CIA to basically completely, if not abolish it, completely marginalize it and turn over American intelligence capability to the military and the control over it to the new National Intelligence Director. That's a revolution within the form. Or take a hurricane and the breach of a federal government levee and the flooding of an entire major U.S. city, like the Katrina disaster. And you say, oh, well, that can never be allowed to happen again. The national government who built that levee that failed, the national government that prevented the locals and private interests who tried to come and help in New Orleans from intervening, the national government who botched that, helping lead to the deaths of approximately, was it 3,000 people or so who died in New Orleans? Well, you take that outrage and you use that to reorder control over the state guard units in this country. And you pass a law saying that the president can now seize control over the state guard units without even so much as consulting the state governors about it. That is a revolution within the form. And this war czar is just another example. We'll see who they can take, who they can get to take the job. Would you want the job as war czar? To come in, you know, 4.5 years into America's state of permanent warfare and take all the responsibility for it? I sure as hell wouldn't. I'm glad my job is just criticizing them. No, I'd be the war czar. And then I'd probably just do a coup and murder the president, the vice president, and make myself the dictator and bring all of our soldiers home from every country in the world. And then I would abolish my own office and resign. But, you know, that's just me. If they offered me the job as war czar, I would end the empire. Anyway, that's the president's job. That is his national security advisor's job. The idea that somehow, what, the reason that George Bush lost two wars is because he didn't have a bureaucrat in the right position over state and defense? Is that the problem? Wasn't this guy, isn't the reason everybody loved this guy so much is because he had a master's in business and everybody said what a great CEO? I don't know, because we all know that he did nothing but waste all of his father's friends' money until the Clear Channel boys gave him the Texas Rangers to sell. But yeah, that was what was going to be the big strength of George W. Bush, was he was such a great business manager. He's going to take good care of things for us. And yeah, now for some reason that means that we now need a new war czar. And just like the head of the Department of Homeland Security, and just like the new Director of National Intelligence, the new war czar position is one that will never go away. That's the way it works. It's called the Ratchet Effect, from Robert Higgs' great book, Crisis and Leviathan. Every time something bad happens, especially when it's the government's own damn fault, whether intentionally or unintentionally, they get to expand their power. And when the crisis is over, they get to keep their power. It never quite goes back. Sometimes the government will shrink a little bit. The government shrank a bit after World War II. But did they go back to pre-New Deal? To pre-empire fascist America at war? No. No, they didn't. No, in fact, Bob Taft, who ran on that platform, lost in the primaries to Ike Eisenhower, who kept things the way they were. And you know, even if it had been Robert Taft, he would have kept us out of, or he would have got us out of Korea faster than Ike, and he probably would have done some things to withdraw the American Empire, but he certainly wasn't going to be able, even if he wanted to take the country the size and the power of the national government back to where it was before the great dictator, the Tsarina, Franklin D. Roosevelt, with his suicide-proof 2-foot-deep swimming pool. There's no way. Sorry, I love Francis E. Dick. That shit's so funny. There's no way that the government would ever be able to be shrunk back to the way it was before FDR. And so will it be today? Someone eventually will, you know, unless somehow this idea gets dropped because of negative publicity, which is doubtful, there will be a new war czar in America, and the position will last as long as the state does. I don't know how you could ever repeal it. Ever see Star Wars 3, where the Jedi say, yeah, well, now that the war's over, we're going to make sure that the Chancellor gives all his power back. And Anakin Skywalker says he's not going to give up his power. He's a politician. The one we've been searching for. Anyway, that's the way it works, man. That's the first lesson of government. You give them power, they'll never give it back. And even better, they will use their own screw-ups as the excuse to expand their power in the first place. And I guess then the second rule of politics is you'll fall for it every single time. Oh my God, did you hear that the government had prior knowledge about the September 11th attack? And if they had had their act together at all, they at least most likely could have stopped it? Oh my goodness. Well, we better let them create a Department of Homeland Security to seize control of all of our local police departments. Yeah, that'll teach them, I guess. Yeah. Anyway, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and here's the song. Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm sorry, I don't have any interviews lined up today. It's been a real pain in the ass getting anybody to answer me back over the last couple of days, but got a great one tomorrow with Andrew Coburn. He's the author of the new book about Donald Rumsfeld. It's called, don't make a mess, Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy by Andrew Coburn. Excellent book, and it's going to be an excellent interview tomorrow. Those Coburn brothers, I'll tell you what, I'm impressed. Alex, Patrick, and Andrew, all three of those guys, very accomplished journalists. And I know that at least Alex, I don't know about all of them, I know at least Alex Coburn is some brand of leftist, collectivist, or something of some kind, but man, he's cool. I don't know. I don't have any real complaints. I've never really got to sit down and argue with him all about private property rights and so forth, but, he stuck up for the Branch Davidians when no one else on the left did, when no liberals would stand up for, the Branch Davidians. Alexander Coburn did. And, in fact, Anthony Gregory had a great bit on the Lou Rockwell blog, talking about Alex Coburn and how, he has called out the global warming movement as a front for big business, trying to get the government to create all these new pollution credits and subsidies and all this other stuff. Which I haven't read Coburn's stuff. I'm only going off of Anthony's hearsay, but you know, I assume he's making the argument that, you know, whether or not there is a problem, that the radical leftists, as the case has been, I'm always trying to tell you guys, the case has been since the 1880s, really, 1890s at least, that the radical left most often is bought and paid for by the people they think are their worst enemies, the big evil Wall Street capitalist types. And the Wall Street capitalist types don't buy up the left-wingers to keep them quiet. They buy them up to make them louder. And they buy them up because left-wingers apparently think that if there's a problem, government must solve it. Government is the only answer. Government is what we must do. And of course, that is what the capitalists want. They don't want free enterprise. They want to socialize their costs. They want to keep their profits, but socialize their costs onto the rest of us. And like the Kyoto Treaty, for example, is strictly about creating all these new pollution credits that these corporations and states can buy and sell and trade among each other. And it's just a new kind of fiat currency for, you know, a new way for politically connected interests to make a killing off of the taxpayers of the world. That's all it is. Anyway, see, there I go off on a tangent about the brother of the guy who I'm going to interview tomorrow. It's all interconnected, dude. Okay, so here's the point. You guys may remember yesterday, I read this article from the Christian Science Monitor at the start of the show about the massive Shiite protests in Najaf and in Kufa, the followers of Muqtada al-Sadr, hundreds of thousands of them protesting. Remember that? Well, you may also remember that in that article, was this paragraph. The U.S. military also issued a statement on Sunday calling the operation in Diwania, dubbed Black Eagle, a great success so far. It said it detained 39 militiamen and killed an unspecified number. It has also uncovered many large caches of weapons. And now here's the important part, okay? Including factories that make explosively formed penetrators, EFPs, devices that Washington accuses Tehran of supplying to Sadr's militia. Okay, so you remember the EFPs. They're the explosively formed penetrators. When Bush came out, he originally tried the trial balloon for this approximately a year ago. More than a year ago now, but just a few months ago, they brought out this argument in full force that the reason Americans are dying in Iraq is because Shiite militias are killing them with Iranian-made roadside bombs. I know what you're saying. Americans haven't been fighting really against the Shiites since August of 2004, that the guys who kill Americans with roadside bombs in Iraq are overwhelmingly Sunnis, members of the Baathist/jihadist Sunni Arab insurgency against the American occupation. Those are the guys using roadside bombs. Have there been, you know, a few cases where Americans have been killed in Shiite parts of Iraq by bombs that were probably placed by Shiites? Sure. But as an organized effort of the Mahdi army? No. And certainly not as an organized effort of the Badr Corps, that is the army of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, the other and probably biggest Shiite militia in Iraq, because, of course, they're the government. They're the people that America has installed in power. So, nope, they're not the ones using roadside bombs. But anyway, the assertion goes that these EFP roadside bombs are so deadly and dangerous that they couldn't possibly be made by the Iraqis. They're coming from Iran. That's right, the Quds force is doing it. And the only question is whether Ahmadinejad's behind it himself or not. But we know for a fact that these bombs are coming from Iran. And yet, here we go. From yesterday's Christian Science Monitor, the American Marine Corps, was it the Marine Corps or the Army? I'm sorry, I guess it was the Army. The American Army in the town of Diwania, which is just not far south of Baghdad, found a factory that makes these explosively formed penetrators. You might remember yesterday when I read that paragraph, I went, Oh, I thought those had to be from Iran, huh? But I skipped right on. Well, after the show, I went to LouRockwell.com, and he had a great link to the Eschaton blog, which is, I guess, one of the biggest, most important political blogs in the world or something, the Atrios blog. And, and wow, it turns out that Reuters had picked up the same statement about the EFP factory being discovered in Iraq. And the Washington Post ran the story. The bloggers at Eschaton went and got the Google cache of the Washington Post version of the Reuters story. And you can read all about this, of course, at my blog, thestressblog.com, or at the antiwar.com blog. The title, Washington Post Liars Caught. And in the original Washington Post version, and the JPEG is here, they got the screen capture or whatever going on over there. Atrios does. And here, the story originally ran in the Washington Post saying, quoting this military spokesman, Blackwell said troops facing scattering resistance discovered a factory. Oops. That produced explosively formed penetrators, a particularly deadly type of roadside bomb, et cetera, et cetera. That's from the Washington Post version of the Reuters story that carried the same information that the Christian Science Monitor reported via me to you yesterday. Well, check this out. That paragraph is now missing from the Washington Post story. But, says Atrios, you do have this, quote, the new version of the Washington Post story. The U.S. military said two U.S. soldiers died in separate roadside bombings in the east and west of Baghdad on Friday. One of the bombs was an explosively formed projectile, a particularly deadly type of device which Washington accuses Iran of supplying Iraqi militants. Wow. So, the Reuters piece included a paragraph that said American forces found a factory that makes these EFP bombs, these roadside bombs, these IEDs that are so sophisticated that they need a new acronym. They found a factory. Reuters reported it. The Washington Post ran the Reuters article. Google Capture proves that it originally contained the paragraph explaining that Americans had found a factory that makes these kind of bombs in Iraq. And then the Washington Post went in with their X-Acto knife and they cut that paragraph out and replaced it with one saying an American soldier was killed by one of these kinds of bombs that Washington accuses Iran of sending into Iraq. What a disgrace. How many newspapers around the country picked up the Washington Post version of that Reuters story? You know, I flipped on the cable news channels this morning before the show, and there was MSNBC hairdo girl sitting up there all morning long accusing Iran of supplying these bombs to the Shiite militias. Now, is it possible that Iran is arming Shiite militias? I guess so. But since the Shiite militias are the Iraqi government and America's allies, I hardly see how that makes them to blame for the deaths of Americans fighting the Sunni insurgency in order to protect it from those Shiites they've empowered. Wow. I must be missing something. Who's the editor at the Washington Post with the X-Acto knife? Who's the guy that cut out the paragraph that says they found a factory that makes these bombs in Iraq? And is he going to have to, you know, publicly stab himself in the guts with a sword? Is he going to commit harikari and say, I'm sorry for attempting to lie you Americans into another war? The shame, you know, can only be overcome by suicide? Will he even be asked to resign, or will he be promoted? Will any of the other reporters at the Washington Post resign over this and say, I'm tired of working for this propaganda rag? Will any of the other writers at the Post even blink? Do they even care? I don't know. See, my problem is I went on and on and on. I should have kept it real short and sweet. The Washington Post editors are liars. And when they see the truth accidentally make it into print, at least on their website, they run in there with the highlight and the delete button to remove the truth that tends to contradict our government's assertions about the government of Iran killing Americans in Iraq. That's what they do. They are liars, and they're trying to lie you into another war. And, you know, for me, I don't approve of that. That's just me, I guess. I don't think it's okay for the Washington Post to go rewriting Reuters stories to take the truth out and put lies in their place. Particularly when we're talking about blatantly false accusations or at least misleadingly made accusations by our government against the government of Iran that our government is just itching to bomb. But, yeah, again, maybe that's just me. If I worked for the Post, I'd resign over this, man. I mean, what do these reporters think, that the Washington Post reputation is going to get better from here? Somehow I doubt that. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. The phone number here is 646-6446, 646-6446. Tell me what you think of the Post. That's the number two newspaper of record, I guess, right? Whatever the Washington Post says is true, is good enough to have a war based on it, you know? That's what Dick Cheney likes to do. Dick Cheney likes to go on TV and says, see, it even says right here in the Washington Post. And, yeah, meanwhile, if you want the debunking of America's accusations against Iran for supplying these roadside bombs, to the Americans, then by all means, research at antiwar.com. I've written about it. Gareth Porter's written about it. We've at least run links to 10 or 15 different stories discrediting this. In fact, I think if you probably just type into your Google search engine, Iran bombs Iraq, that, you know, within the first couple pages, you'll find four or five articles debunking these accusations that somehow Iran is arming anyone but America's allies in Iraq. But check this out. This is from The Guardian. I just made a wild and crazy assertion about America, the American government doing everything they can to try to start a war with Iran. This is from The Guardian. I found the link from Justin Raimondo's article on antiwar.com today. From The Guardian, the U.S. offered to take military action on behalf of the 15 British sailors and Marines held by Iran, including buzzing Iranian Revolutionary Guard positions with warplanes, The Guardian has learned. In the first few days after the captives were seized and British diplomats were getting no news from Tehran on their whereabouts, Pentagon officials asked their British counterparts, what do you want us to do? They offered a series of military options, a list which remains top secret given the mounting risk of war between the U.S. and Iran. But one of the options was for U.S. combat aircraft to mount aggressive patrols over Iranian Revolutionary Guard bases in Iran to underline the seriousness of the situation. The British declined the offer and said the U.S. could calm the situation by staying out of it. Whew. Was there any doubt of that? You know, when I spoke with Ron Paul last week, by the way, the transcript of that interview is up at antiwar.com today. When I spoke with him, we discussed media reports coming out of Britain that America was screwing up or attempting to screw up the negotiations between the British and the Iranians over those 15 sailors And here we have from The Guardian, America said, ooh, can we use this as a pretext for war? How about this? How about we'll go buzzing our warplanes over Iranian military positions and see if we can't get one shot down and turn this little, week-long ping-pong-playing captivity problem into a full-blown Gulf of Tonkin incident. Remember the Maine, sink the Lusitania, oh my God, Pearl Harbor was a complete surprise attack type fake lie into war. And then we can, bomb the hell out of Iran, and then the Iranian people will rise up, overthrow their government, and install an America-friendly one. That's how these things work. That's what happened in Iraq, remember? Oh, wait. I'm sorry, I was confusing what they said was going to happen with what did happen. Yeah, same thing here. Well, why is the American government so hell-bent on bombing Iran? I know what you're thinking. It's because they're making nuclear weapons, right? Everybody knows that. Except if you read the foreign press, which, of course, I do every day here on this show for you guys, you'll find out that there's quite a bit of discrepancy between Iranian claims and what they've been able to prove. They talk big about their progress in their nuclear technology, and yet they've made very little real progress. I know from speaking with Dr. Gordon Prather that their best centrifuges are P1, Generation 1 Yurenko centrifuges, which run on ball bearings and basically are pieces of crap. Yurenko is now on their 9th or 12th or something generation of centrifuge. The Iranians have, 1971 technology or something over there. And they've had an inordinate amount of trouble enriching uranium, getting their cascades to work correctly, to even enrich minimal amounts of uranium hexafluoride gas to 3.6% U-235, which is hardly pure enough to make a bomb out of it. And anyway, our government knows this. The CIA reported in a national intelligence estimate last year. Seymour Hersh reported all about it in the New Yorker magazine. The Next Act is the name of the article last November. That the CIA says that Iran's 10 years from a nuclear bomb, and that's if they were to begin trying now. Here's an article. This is actually from the American Press, although it's an Associated Press article by Vladimir Ischenkov. I don't know where I got Ovich at the end there. Ischenkov, Associated Press writer. Moscow, Russia voiced skepticism Tuesday about Iran's announcement of a dramatic expansion of its uranium enrichment program, saying it had yet to receive confirmation of the claim from the UN's nuclear watchdog. France and Australia also questioned Iran's claim of acquiring an industrial-scale nuclear fuel production capability. Two UN inspectors have arrived in Iran to visit its uranium enrichment plant, the official Islamic Republic news agency reported. An official of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization confirmed their arrival and said the visit was routine. The official spoke on condition of anonymity as he was not authorized to speak to the media. Iran said Monday it had begun operating 3,000 centrifuges, nearly 10 times the previously known number, in defiance of UN demands that it halt its nuclear program or face increased sanctions. The United States, Britain, France, and others criticized the announcement. Russia was unaware, however, of, quote, any recent technological breakthroughs in the Iranian nuclear program that would change the format of its enrichment effort. Foreign Ministry spokesman Mikhail Kaminin said in a statement, the Russian government helped build Iran's only nuclear reactor and knows its nuclear program well. Quote, we haven't got confirmation yet that they have actually begun uranium enrichment at the new Cascades. That's Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. French Foreign Ministry spokesman Jean-Baptiste Maty also questioned the Iranian claim, saying Tuesday, there are announcements and then there is technological reality. Australian Foreign Minister Alexander Downer voiced similar doubts about Iran's ability to produce substantial quantities of enriched uranium. Now, I'm not sure if that's true or not. On Monday, analysts said the claims seemed questionable. David Albright, a former UN weapons inspector, said it would be very hard to believe that Iran had been able to enlarge its centrifuge cascade so dramatically. It all hinges on whether Iran will be able to get the machines working together at a constant rate. Iran is known to have had 328 centrifuges operating at its Natanz enrichment facility in central Iran. For months, it has been saying it plans to launch an expanded program of 3,000, likely to be set up in a large underground area at Natanz to protect them from airstrikes. In the enrichment process, uranium gas is pumped into centrifuges which spin and purify the gas. Enriched to a low degree, the result is fuel for a reactor. But to a high degree, it creates material for a nuclear warhead. And, of course, the headline yesterday, you heard me read it on the air here on Anti-War Radio, Iranian announcement causes fear. Skepticism. Yeah, the fear was only from the American government. You heard it. Here's the Russians and the French and the Australians. David Albright, the former UN weapons inspector. Everybody saying, oh, yeah, right. Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it, that they've even been able to increase their centrifuge capacity to the ability to enrich to 3.6% on any sort of large-scale basis. Yeah, right, says the entire world's so-called whatever community of nuclear experts and government experts on this matter. And it will only be a matter of days before we hear from the IAEA that it's all a bunch of crap, and that Iran, which denies to this day, quite credibly, I must say, that they even have a nuclear weapons program. Well, they talk real tough about their nuclear program, which isn't a weapons program at all, and like to try to brag about how successful they've been. And yet every time they're made fools of, claiming that they have all these centrifuges operating, which they don't. So again, you know, the CIA says Iran's 10 years away from a nuke. I'd say more like 15 at the rate they're going. Give me a break. 10 years is being optimistic for them. And that is, again, if they were to attempt to make nuclear weapons now. So, gee whiz, I don't know. Are there any credible reasons to bomb Iran? It ain't because they have nuclear weapons. And it's not because they're supplying bombs to America's enemies in Iraq. Is there a good reason to bomb them at all? Other than the Israel lobby wants us to, because they apparently take Aminajad's bragging about his nuclear program at face value or something. That doesn't seem like a good enough reason for Americans to have to die in a war to me. What do you guys think? I don't know. That sounds a little excessive for Americans to have to go and fight and die in wars for third countries based on accusations which are uniformly false. Seems like a little much to me. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. But, you know, it says here, here's another headline from antiwar.com. Iran is threatening to pull out of the nonproliferation treaty if further pressured, they say. This is from the Agence France-Presse. Iran will be obliged to pull out of the nuclear nonproliferation treaty if it is subjected to further international pressure over its atomic program, chief nuclear negotiator Ali Larjani warned on Monday. Quote, if they pressure us further, we will have no choice but to reconsider our membership in the nonproliferation treaty as Parliament has ruled, Larjani said, referring to a law agreed by Parliament last year allowing the government to reduce cooperation with the UN nuclear watchdog. So here Iran is a member in good standing of the nonproliferation treaty, who have safeguards agreements with the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, who have inspectors everywhere. They have the quote-unquote inalienable right in the nonproliferation treaty to enrich uranium for peaceful purposes, and in fact, America is mandated to help them do it. All other nuclear power countries are mandated to help them produce nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. And in fact, for a time during negotiations for between 2003 and I think right around the beginning of 2006, they even were abiding by an additional protocol to their safeguards agreement, one that had not been ratified by the Iranian parliament, but they were going along with it anyway. And what that meant was their enrichment of uranium at all was suspended And the IAEA had even more carte blanche than they'd ever had before. But that wasn't good enough for the United States, and so we pushed them and pushed them until they finally dropped that and stopped abiding by the additional protocol to their safeguards agreement that had never been ratified by their parliament, and so they were not bound by it. And they dropped that, and they started enriching uranium again. They still can't get their act together, but here the United States and the European powers are going along with this, are pretending that for Iran to have an internationally monitored nuclear program is tantamount to them producing an arsenal of nuclear weapons, and that they must be stopped. The United Nations Security Council has ruled that that Iran must cease enriching uranium, even though the United Nations Security Council does not have a leg to stand on in demanding such things. They have the quote-unquote inalienable right, according to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But if you're on a march to war and you're looking for an excuse to bomb Iran, well, pushing them and pushing them and pushing them until they finally withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty and kick the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors out of the country, well, now you can have your war. Now, all of the opponents of war who say, hey, 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 the IAEA is there, they're not making weapons, well, now they don't have a leg to stand on anymore. Sorry, the IAEA isn't there anymore. They're not a member of the NPT anymore. And so now we have to prevent them from obtaining nuclear weapons, et cetera, et cetera. That's how the line goes. This is a deliberate plan by the United States. The Cheney administration is deliberately trying to provoke Iran into withdrawing from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and I sure hope they don't do it. I'm no fan of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Of course, I think America should dismantle its entire nuclear arsenal unilaterally. We have enough conventional forces to reduce any capital city on Earth to rubble if anyone dares mess with us. And so, you know, I don't think we need nuclear weapons to do that. I'm completely opposed to the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Although I don't think there should be a world federal system to control such things, and I certainly don't want to see anybody end up with a monopoly on nuclear weapons. I'd rather every country on Earth have them than only one, or only the UN or something like that. So I'm really not in favor of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. However, right now, it's the only thing standing between the U.S. and the war. Or is it just a tripwire? Is it just an excuse, a casus belli machine? You know, something that exists simply to cite as we go to war. See, the UN says it's a problem, but they're not willing to do anything about it, so we will. But there you go. If Iran withdraws from the NPT, you can consider that a major step toward war. Because the American government will use that as an excuse. Absolutely, they will. And I think that's what they're going for. I think it's on purpose that they're deliberately trying to antagonize the Iranians and get them to withdraw from the NPT. I'm here to tell you, man, a war with Iran will be a major disaster. Just, you know, a couple off the top of my head. Oil, the price of oil will go through the roof, maybe more than $200 a barrel. If Iran really tries hard, they can probably shut down all shipping out of the Straits of Hormuz, out of the Persian Gulf, at least for a time, for a few weeks maybe, which would be enough to perhaps send the entire planet into a global depression, or at least, a great deal of the financial systems in the world are propped up by governments, by smoke and mirrors rather than, markets and real wealth and commodities. And so, if you have, a massive price increase in oil like that, the shockwaves and reverberations between central banks and major industries, et cetera, around the world are, you know, really unpredictable, but, beyond, knowing that it could be really rough. Really rough. Also, if Iran chose, I'm just guessing, but certainly it's within their capability to kill Pervez Musharraf and have a coup d'etat in Pakistan. Even if it's not the Iranians who end up, ruling it in the end, they could still get an assassination done in Pakistan, I'm pretty sure. This would be a major problem for the United States. The King Abdullah in Jordan may very well fall. The so-called Arab street, all over the Arab and frankly all over the Muslim world, near a billion people, would be absolutely enraged. Osama bin Laden's thesis that America is at war, not against terrorism, but against Islam, and so it's okay to resort to terrorism, will be confirmed in the minds of more millions and millions of people. I guess the degree of control that Iran wields over Hezbollah and Hamas is questionable, but I think it's likely that you could have Hezbollah and perhaps Hamas fighters committing terrorist acts in Israel, and perhaps the war would start again in Lebanon and Syria, between Israel and Lebanon and Syria. They didn't expand the war to Syria last time. They very well could this time. When the informed people talk about an upcoming war with Iran, a war with Syria at the same time is basically just always in parentheses there as part of the same discussion. Also, you could have Hezbollah and Hamas types and sympathizers all across Europe committing attacks. So there's really no telling. You're talking about you know, the domino effect. Remember the domino effect? This is why we have to fight in Southeast Asia, is because if South Vietnam goes communist, then all the rest of them will too. Well, we have the new domino theory now, only this time we're the Reds, and I don't think the theory of how this is supposed to work is any more accurate than the domino theory in the 60s and 70s was. But certainly, some dominoes are going to fall. They're not all going to become pro-Western democracy, wonderful allies of ours. But some serious dominoes are going to fall if America bombs Iran. And in fact, I'm trying to remember who it was the other day that I was reading or was talking to me on this very radio show. Oh, it was Ron Paul. It was Dr. Ron Paul in my interview of him, the anti-war Republican, which is running today in text form on antiwar.com, who said, look, you know, once we start bombing Iran and they start going after our troops in Iraq, of course, that's the biggest consequence of a war against Iran that I didn't mention, was that Iran has a tremendous capability to have the Shiites in Iraq go to full-scale war and turn against our troops there. And they could cross the border. The Iranian Special Forces guys could cross the border, go into Iraq, cause a lot of trouble, take out targets in Kuwait, etc. And then, of course, from there, the war would just continue to escalate. George Bush, of course, would say, well, we can't let them do that. We can't let them attack in Iraq and then make it back across the border. We've got to go after them. And so before too long, you'd have double the number of American troops in the region attempting to force a land invasion of Iran, which, again, it's not really on the table. Everything everybody's been talking about is airstrikes. But as Philip Giraldi, the former CIA operative, said on this show, once you start bombing Iran, what are you going to do? Say, okay, we bombed you for 2 weeks, war's over, and now cool it? And we're just supposed to expect them to not fight back? You know, wars don't work out like you plan. They might start like you plan, but they never keep going like you plan. And, you know, these crazy, and it's still, Washington Post today, George Bush still listening to Fred Kagan at the American Enterprise Institute for all his advice. I keep my options open. I get great advice. I listen to Dick Cheney and to the guys at the American Enterprise Institute. Yeah, that's where the president is getting his information from. And America is headed on a path toward disaster. I don't know how bad it's going to be, but if we bomb Iran, it's going to be pretty damn bad. And, you know, I had a guy email me and said, wait a minute, man, are you saying that my nephew that's over there training the Badr Brigade to be the new Iraqi army, that if we bomb Iran, that his Badr Brigade students are going to shoot him in the back? And I said, yeah. Yeah, that's what your president is setting your nephew up for, bro. Anybody out there whose friends and family are training the Iraqi army? Yeah, those are the guys who are going to be shooting at the American army if this government bombs Iran. Those guys are going to turn on our guys in one heartbeat. It's a really bad idea. Did I make myself clear? I think bombing Iran is a really bad idea. I think all the excuses for it are lies. Yeah, I think I made my case. The number here is 646-6446. 646-6446. If you're from out of town, it's 512-646-6446. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, folks, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. That was Mastodon with the little filler music. Bumper music. All right, yeah, the number here is 646-6446, 646-6446. If you're from out of town listening live on the internet, it's 512-646-6446. Go ahead and call in, chime in on whatever you like, if you like. I got plenty of news. I mentioned that my interview from last week with Dr. Ron Paul is up on antiwar.com today, the transcript. It's called The Anti-War Republican. I urge everybody to look at that. And, you know, for these interviews, they're for chaos, but they're also for antiwar.com, so I got to keep them completely on the up and up in terms of nonprofit organization rules. So I wasn't allowed to really ask Ron Paul about his campaign, about the response. I certainly am not allowed, at least during an interview that's to run on antiwar.com, I'm not allowed to say, that's why I'm voting for this guy. He's true founding fathers material. In fact, if he'd been around back then, he probably would have voted with Patrick Henry and them against the Constitution because he loves liberty that much. The guy's anti-war, anti-state, pro-gun, pro-capitalism, pro-property rights. You know, he's sworn to the Constitution. He'll tell you it ain't perfect, but he's sworn to it, and he does not believe, and he certainly does not act as though he has any more power than is expressly granted to him as a congressman in Article 1, Section 8. They call him Dr. No. And so I wasn't really allowed to sing the guy's praises during that interview, but I'd like to now. If you're not familiar with Dr. Paul, especially if you consider yourself some type of liberal leftist or another, and you're having a real hard time swallowing the pro-warmonger Barack Obama or the fascist in the pink dress Hillary Clinton, and you're looking for, you know, someone to, I don't know, preserve the Bill of Rights and America's permanent state of aggressive warfare in the world, etc., like that, you might consider looking into Dr. Ron Paul. He ain't no liberal. In fact, he scores 100% or better or whatever on the conservative index. But you look at how he votes. You look at his voting record. And what he is he's against everything that the government does wrong and most of the things that most people think they do right. And I've met him a couple of times, and the guy, you know, he truly does love liberty. When I asked him my very first question, what are your principles of foreign policy? The first thing he said was, I think we ought to not go around intervening around the world and starting all these wars and causing all this trouble. But more importantly, my oath is to the Constitution, and the Constitution does not authorize aggressive war. It does not authorize empire building and intervening in the affairs of other nations. And so really, regardless of my personal opinion, my job is to, you know, operate a limited constitutional republic, not a global empire. And so, yeah, it happens to go along with his personal beliefs well. What a convenient, you know, thing to happen there. But he really does believe that America should not go around, you know, murdering people. I know it's astounding to hear in this day and age. And it's hilarious to hear these idiot right-wingers who, you know, apparently don't have a couple of brain cells they could rub together for heat, who look at Ron Paul and call him a liberal. Ron Paul, who is the guy who would repeal the New Deal if he had the chance, is a liberal? Ron Paul, who's never voted for any tax increase ever, is a liberal? No, he's not. He's a libertarian and a rightist in the true old right sense. The kind of people who opposed World War II and opposed the creation of the Cold War after it. He's a real classical liberal in the old school sense. Not any kind of socialist, you know, do-gooder. He's not a college professor. He's a baby doctor, for crying out loud. And anyway, you know, I'm probably his worst spokesman in the world. Don't listen to me. Just read about it. Go to the Congressional Record and read Ron Paul's speeches. Go to antiwar.com and read his archives at antiwar.com and at lourockwell.com. You know, learn about this guy. He's 100% different than every other Republican and Democrat that's running for president this time. And he's seriously worth a look. So anyway, that's all I got to say about that, I suppose. Now, this is anti-war radio, and I don't really want to spend too much time on this, but I have to say, I have to bring this up. It's an important story. Not that there aren't thousands and thousands like them every year, but I'm sure you guys heard of these lacrosse players at Duke University who were all accused. I think there was five of them originally. There's three left who were all accused of gang raping this stripper who came to their house party or what have you. Well, it turns out these guys are 100% innocent, and the prosecutor knew it all along. Apparently, the cops knew it in the first place when they first arrested the so-called victim. The cops never believed her story, and apparently no one else did either, including the prosecutor, who, knowing that she was a liar, having solid proof that she was a liar, buried that proof and continued to attempt to prosecute these guys anyway. And it's been almost a year. And just imagine if this happened to you. The prosecutor puts your picture on TV and says your name on TV and says you took part in the gang rape of some poor woman and that they have your DNA to prove it. And they're lying. Imagine if somebody did that to you. Or to your brother, or your father, or someone you know and care about. Oh, well, you know, these guys were a bunch of spoiled, rotten lacrosse players from Duke, so who cares about them? Well, it seems to me that the prosecutor, I believe his name is Michael Nifong, ought to be doing life in prison without the possibility of parole. I never mind, you know, the Ten Commandments about bearing false witness. Isn't it a crime to knowingly and deliberately falsely prosecute an innocent person in this country? Or isn't it? Is there even a law on the books in North Carolina that says if you're a prosecutor and you deliberately attempt to prosecute an innocent person that you know is innocent, that you go to prison for the rest of your life? Is there not a law that says that? Is there a law that says that anywhere in this country? Well, this is probably the first and last time you're going to hear this from me. So listen up closely. There ought to be a law. That's right. There ought to be a law in every state in this union that any prosecutor who knowingly attempts to prosecute an innocent person does life without parole. Period. At the least. Why should a prosecutor in the United States of America be able to indict and parade these kids in front of the camera, ruin their lives based on accusations he knows to be false, and get away with it? Shouldn't he be hung? Shouldn't Michael Nifong, the prosecutor there in North Carolina, right? Duke University? That's my best memory of it. I don't know. Should he not be indicted by a grand jury, tried by a jury of his peers, convicted, sentenced to death, his appeals exhausted, and then kicked off the platform and hung by his neck like Saddam Hussein? Tell me that that wouldn't be justice. Tell me that it's perfectly okay for a prosecutor to knowingly prosecute five innocent people that he knows didn't do it because he gets to be on TV and he gets to be famous and, you know, maybe make some money, get a book deal someday. Well, the Bar Association has filed, you know, for proceedings to revoke this guy's credentials as a lawyer. But who's going to prosecute him? Nobody? You know, I've often said, if you want to be a murderer, work for the government. You want to kick in doors and terrorize people in their own homes? work for the government. Don't be the kind of criminal that the cops are chasing around all day. No, be a cop. If you like that feeling of taking human lives away, why, they're hiring down at the local police department. Why would you risk yourself being a lawbreaker when you can murder anyone you want, you can frame anyone you want, you can prosecute any innocent person you want as long as you work for the government? Kidnapping, extortion, you can commit any crime as long as you're a state employee, and it's perfectly okay. Perfectly okay. You know, I wonder what would happen if poor Michael Nifong was duped. We know that that's not the case. I urge you all to go read William L. Anderson's archives about this story at lewrockwell.com. He's kept a very good track this whole time. It's not the case. The guy deliberately buried DNA evidence that exonerated the accused. That's what he did. But let's pretend, for example, that I was the eyewitness. And they didn't have the DNA evidence, or it was inconclusive, or what have you. And Michael Nifong wanted to prosecute these guys. And I went up on the stand and said, yeah, that's right. I was there at the party, and she's telling the truth. These five guys did gang rape her and beat her. And I know it's true, because I was there, I saw them do it, and I called 911. Okay, now, if I went up there on the witness stand and said that, and was lying, that would be perjury, right? The crime of bearing false witness, especially not just perjury, but perjury in falsely accusing someone of a crime. It would be the right thing, you know, for me to have to do 20 years for something like that if I got up there and falsely testified against these guys at their prosecution. But apparently it's perfectly okay if I'm the district attorney. It's perfectly okay to lie on TV, to lie to the judge, to frame these five kids and attempt to prosecute them for rape and kidnapping and battery for a crime that I know they didn't commit. As long as I'm the prosecutor, that's perfectly okay. Is that America? Is that the USA that you were taught that you lived in when you were a little kid? Is that the Bill of Rights as you probably didn't even have a chance to learn it in school? Is that the way the United States is supposed to be? That the prosecutors can just go ahead and lock up anyone they want and make up whatever lies they want, bury whatever evidence they want? And I know what you're going to say. Well, the fact that these guys, the last three, are having the charges against them dropped today, Scott, proves that the system works. Well, no, it doesn't. It proves that the system works if you're a millionaire white boy lacrosse player. And your case is eerily reminiscent of, you know, the famous Tawana Brawley case. And, you know, the media bloggers and LewRockwell.com writers happen to pick up on it. But how many innocent people are prosecuted and locked in cages in this country every single day? How many? Do you know? Do you have a guess? I don't know. But if I guessed, I'd say hundreds. Maybe on a really good day for the state, a couple of thousand? Couldn't be less than hundreds of innocent people locked in cages, assessed fines, violated one way or another. Innocent people for things that they did not do. Yeah, never mind, you know, the laws against things that aren't really crimes anyway and stuff. But I'm talking about people who are completely innocent by statute. How many of them are prosecuted every day in this country? At least hundreds. At least hundreds of people. And probably more of them resemble the false accuser in this case than the falsely accused. That is poor and black and unable to defend themselves. That's the American criminal justice system. Like my buddy Jacob Hornberger says, probably the best one ever devised by humankind on earth. And yet look at it. What a disgrace it is. I mean, really, you probably get just as fair of a trial in front of the Guantanamo Tribunal at this point. That's the way it seems to me, anyway. This is Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and if anybody wants to call in the show, it's 646-6446, 646-6446. 512, if you're out of town, is the area code, 512-646-6446. I'll be happy to take y'all's calls if you want. But yeah, I really think that. I think that this guy Nifong should be hung. I think he should get a grand jury indictment and a criminal petit jury trial, and he should be convicted and all his appeals exhausted, and then I think somebody ought to pull the trap door out from under him. And he ought to hang from his neck until it snaps. Is there something wrong with that? Am I going overboard? Is it not a death penalty offense to knowingly and willfully, wrongfully prosecute five innocent people on charges of rape and kidnapping? Attempting to sentence them to, we all know what happens to rapists in prison. Hell, it's part of our whole culture that, you know, pretty much anybody who goes to prison gets raped. Not that that's necessarily true, but that's what, you know, we all believe. And we all know that if you're a rapist or a child molester and you go to prison, oh, you're gonna get it, pal. Is it not okay? Is it okay? Did I miss something? Is it okay for Michael Nafong to try to sentence these five guys to, years and years of rape in prison for a crime they didn't commit? Should he not be hung from his neck? Am I getting carried away here? Okay, life in prison without parole. How about that? How about Michael Nafong gets raped in prison for the rest of his life? How's that? We could call that justice. All right, I'm going to say it one more time. This is the last time you're ever going to hear me say this. There ought to be a law to go along with that one I proposed before, that any prosecutor knowingly prosecutes an innocent person automatically gets life with no parole, and that every state in the union ought to pass a law like that. There ought to be another one that goes along with that that says if you're a government employee, you are guilty until proven innocent. How about that? How about Michael Nafong goes on trial, and they go ahead and they put him up on the platform with the rope around his neck, and the guy with the hood with his hand on the lever, and then they start the trial and say, all right, Michael Nafong, prove your innocence, pal. The burden is on you, Mr. Prosecutor, to show that you're not guilty. How do you like that? There ought to be a law that says if you're a government employee, you are guilty until proven innocent. And anytime anyone accuses you of anything ever, particularly in your official capacity, operating under the color of law, you're guilty until proven innocent. Wrap the rope around his neck and then start the trial. Let's see if he can talk his way out of this noose. I know, that's not the American way. The American way says that the same law applies to the prosecutors as to the defendants. But do you believe that? Does anybody believe that Michael Nafong is going to be prosecuted at all? So then why is it unreasonable to say that the burden of proof ought to be reversed? And that the burden of proof ought to be on him to show his innocence? We all know he won't even be charged at all for knowingly and deliberately burying evidence and willfully prosecuting five innocent young men, putting their names on TV and calling them rapists and kidnappers. So, you know, I figure, as long as we're living in fantasy world where there's a rule of law in this country that somehow applies to the people who apply it, as long as we're buying into that fiction, why can't I just go ahead and fantasize and get some real justice around here and see some prosecutors hung from their necks for a change? Wouldn't that be fun to be a judge after, you know, a couple of weeks of prosecutors being hung around the country? So, you're bringing charges against Mr. Johnson, are you? Pretty certain you got an airtight case there, aren't you, Mr. Prosecutor? You better be sure, buddy. How about that? How about if anyone in America is... Oh, here's the third time. There ought to be a law. And of course, you notice that the only laws that I ever recommend are only to apply to government employees. You picked up on that, right? How about this? There ought to be a law that anytime anyone is acquitted, the prosecutor is immediately indicted for false prosecution. And then they wrap the rope around their neck and put them on the platform and tell them, all right, you better start trying to prove your innocence, pal. The burden's on you. How about that? How about every acquittal equals an automatic indictment of the prosecutor who attempted to bring the charges? Oh, I'm getting carried away now. Wow, I'm living in a pretend fantasy world where there's justice in the criminal justice system. What am I, crazy? What am I, crazy prosecutors being held responsible for prosecuting innocent people? This isn't a cartoon. This is the real world, Scott Horton. Snap out of it, pal. That'll be the day. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. This is Chaos in Austin, Texas.
Please, please, please listen. I've got one or two things to say.
Tell us both of them.
Look, you've got it all wrong. You don't need to follow me. You don't need to follow anybody. You've got to think for yourself. You're all individuals.
Yes, we're all individuals.
You're all different.
Yes, we are all different.
You all got to work it out for yourself.
Yes, we've got to work it out for ourselves.
Exactly. Anyone tell you what to do? Otherwise, I'll know!
Friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 and 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas, streaming live worldwide on the internet, KAOS959.com. You can hear the transcripts of, archives of all the interviews, none of which obviously are taking place today, at antiwar.com. It's Anti-War Radio, man, and keep all the interview archives there, not just mine, but also those of the great libertarian anti-war radio host, or do I repeat myself there, Charles Goyette from KFNX 1100 AM in Phoenix, Arizona. We keep all of his great interviews there at Anti-War Radio as well, so please check that out at antiwar.com. My own blog is thestressblog.com. Why not join in at thestressblog.com? And argue with all the crazy kooks in the comment section. Love you guys, man. Yeah, so that's it. Anti-war and stress and, oh yeah. Why not check out libertystickers.com? Not everybody can have an I Hate the Government radio show like me. But you can put hateful slogans on the back of your car for everybody in traffic to read. So, check out the Scott Horton section at libertystickers.com. There's, I don't know, 150 or so in there. And supposedly soon there will be another probably 50 new ones in there. But I don't know how long that's going to take. That's libertystickers.com, the Scott Horton section there. And back to work here. I don't really want to say anything about the stupid Don Imus thing, except that, you know, people ought to get over the whole hurt feelings thing. You know, racism is stupid, and it's not cool to say racist stuff to people, but you know what? It's also not cool to sit there and boo-hoo and cry like a little child when you're a full-grown adult because somebody called you names. Oh, man, you called me names. Boo, I'm going to cry. Give me a break, dude. This guy, Don Imus, who cares what he says anyway? The guy's got the least listened to, well, I don't know if that's true. He's got the most boring radio show in the world. Who cares what Don Imus says? Oh, he called you a bad name. Wah! Don't you know that freedom is the most important thing? Not having your feelings saved from being hurt? Don't you know that it's perfectly okay for Don Imus to say anything he wants because he's a human being? What's the matter with this culture? You know, not only did he say, oh, wow, some stupid racist stuff, which is, I guess, a symptom of our sick culture itself, but the reaction, the unending reaction to this is just insanity. I mean, watching the people on TV news carrying on and Al Sharpton and all the people. Yeah, Don Imus said something rude on the radio. Wow. I'm so impressed. And, you know, Steve C. pointed out on my blog, it's perfectly okay when Don Imus says that Palestinians are a bunch of stinking animals and we ought to just nuke them all. It's perfectly okay for Don Imus to say that because, of course, Palestinians are animals, right? That's why America gives more than $3 billion a year to Israel to build their military, to murder Palestinians with and steal land from them with. Right? It's because they're animals. They don't have rights. So it's perfectly okay, right, for Don Imus to say that. But nappy-headed hoes, oh, that's beyond the pale. Beyond the pale. And, you know, that's what freedom means in America now, is freedom to not have your feelings hurt. And as my good buddy DJ Soda Jerk always likes to point out, that's what it means to be a hero, to be a victim. Something bad happened to you, and that's what makes you a hero. And if nothing really bad happened to you, well, go ahead and pretend like you're a victim anyway, because we in America cannot tell the difference between the victim and the hero who protects the victim. No, they're the same thing now. They're the very same thing now. Boo-hoo, Don Imus called me names. I'm going to cry. And again, and I have to bring this up twice because I think it's relevant. Nobody cared when this guy said that the Palestinians were stinking animals who ought to be nuked. Nobody cared when he said that, and very few. Oh, because that's the official American policy. That's right. That's what Americans believe. So that's okay. But Americans, thankfully, no longer think of blacks as animals, most of us. And so, you know, we are offended when we hear somebody like Don Imus, you know, talking bad about these women basketball players or what have you. But no, Palestinians, yeah, it's perfectly okay to slaughter them, including little children, women, whatever. They're just stinking animals. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Scott. Just wanted to talk about Don Imus here.
Sure.
An interesting thing is, though I certainly object to what he said, and I don't think highly of Don Imus in general, it also illustrates a certain double standard, too. The interesting thing is he's using language that actually would have been more tolerated, or certainly wouldn't have been as, if it had come from, Snoop Dogg or some other celebrity. I'm not sure it would have actually gotten that celebrity in as much trouble. I think part of what's going on here, and this also ties in with the Duke prosecution, is you almost are making a mockery of this concept of equal treatment. There's certain, what you could almost call like political crimes, where Don Imus says something that he couldn't say, whereas you could have someone like Michael Savage talk about Muslims as being Islamo-fascist and crazed ragheads and really odious stuff that you'll never really hear very widely criticized, and it just sort of seems to me that this is almost an attempt to really exert power outside the law, to coerce people and silence the range of acceptable opinions. Yeah. I mean, it's that's how I see it. It's not really, not that I really approve of what Dianne Imus says, but as you're saying, with Palestinians or so forth, or when you hear Muslims being denigrated, not nearly as much of an issue.
Right. And I guess it kind of reveals where we're at in this culture. It's taken this long, really, for the American, well, maybe it hasn't taken this long, but it took a hell of a long time for Americans to even wrap their head around the idea that, yeah, in fact, black people are human beings themselves in our own country. You know, I still remember seeing the protesters during the garbage strike in Mississippi, I guess it was, where all their signs simply said, "I am a man." On their signs. I mean, this is our culture. The idea that foreigners are human beings, well, boy, it's going to be another 10 generations before we can wrap our head around that idea, I guess.
It's a sad thing. It's a sad thing. I don't know what else to say about it, but I was kind of surprised, though, that that actually got him in as much trouble as it did, just because I've heard much worse things from other conservative talk show hosts, and I don't know a lot about Don Imus, to be fair, but much worse things said, especially in a political context, about Muslims and other things, and it doesn't seem to really attract that much attention.
Right. Yeah, and you're right about the double standard there, and the I guess as you're saying, it's not so much political enforcement as just pressure group enforcement, PC enforcement. But
correct. Yes.
I kind of made that connection myself this morning between the Duke case, these falsely accused lacrosse players, and this case of the Don Imus calling these basketball players' names. It's the same kind of political correctness that's just gone absolutely crazy, you know? In one case,
yeah.
In the form of the law.
Well, that's what it is. I certainly think everybody should be treated equally, but you want to make examples of certain, like, what I would call, not crimes, but for the sake of this argument, political crimes that are unacceptable. It's unacceptable for Imus to stereotype whatever. And it was inappropriate, certainly, and rude, but I was a little surprised. I mean, I've heard the same thing from rappers and other people, but coming from Imus, I think that's perceived as being less politically acceptable.
Right.
Duke lacrosse thing, too, is what you really had was a political audience that's just looking to essentially verify this notion that essentially these elitist white guys really are out to do harm to minorities in the most evil ways. And really, it was more of a political prosecution than it was a prosecution based on any evidence. Apparently, nobody believed that anything was – nobody believed these charges, but they were just a political scapegoat. It almost reminds me of the movie Bonfire of the Vanities, where you have a fancy Wall Street hotshot who accidentally hits someone in the ghetto, and then it's just exploited by people like Sharpton or whatever just to essentially drive home a political point. And I understand the politics, but the problem is we're getting to the point where you're actually denying equal treatment in the eyes of society of all individuals, too, by trying to correct past wrongs. And I think that's really where the main objection I have with this stuff. And it is unfortunate that in the past, politicians and a lot of people never really thought that we owed anything to blacks who've been in America probably longer than most white people have, for all that matter. But it's unfortunate, but I think we're actually moving – we're just correcting things too far by trying to correct past wrongs, by trying to pick out examples of what we would call ethnic hatred or so forth. And it's a convenient type of ethnic hatred. This we can criticize.
Yeah.
Criticism of Muslims or so forth, still not that important. So
Yeah. That's
all I had to say. I really, I'm going on here, and I'm really not adding to the conversation. But
no, you
in a roundabout way, that's what I was trying to get to.
No, I appreciate it very much. Thanks a lot for your call.
Sure, take care.
And, you know, he's absolutely right. The lady on TV this morning is saying that, you know, the guys, he must be fired. 2 weeks suspension, not good enough. Don Imus must be fired. Because or else, people will think that they are allowed to say what they want, too. And we can't have that. And I'm saying, you know, this has gone way, way too far here. This is America. You know, Thomas Jefferson said, and this has been our tradition for, you know, 230-something years now, that error of opinion is tolerable where reason is left free to combat it. How about the fact that those girls were not nappy-headed hoes? How about the fact that they weren't hoes and they weren't nappy-headed? You know, he was just trying to say, boy, there's some tough broads, man. I wouldn't want to mess with them. That's all he was saying. And, you know, his characterization was false. And, you know, to tisk tisk, Don Imus, don't call people names, jerk. How's that? You hear that? Reason, left free, just combated error of opinion. It wasn't that bad. You know, I really do think that, that liberty is the parent of order, not order makers. And when we go asking these people to create order for us, they just go screwing it up. People need a more hands-off approach to living other people's lives, I think. Don Imus. How come this guy hasn't been routinely criticized and drummed off the air for supporting the Iraq war, huh? For denouncing any opponent of the Iraq war as, you know, being in league with Saddam Hussein. For bringing on every liar in the world to tell us that there were weapons of mass destruction that we had to wage a preemptive war against. Somebody call and tell me that Don Imus was anti-war. Yeah, right. How come he's not been drummed off the air for that? How come, for that matter, the entire editorial board of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, the rest of them haven't all been fired? How come all the shills on TV who made all these grandiose promises based on the government's assertions about the threat of Iraq, how come they haven't been drummed out for that? Oh, call some basketball players some names and it's the end of the damn world. You know, whatever happened to sticks and stones can break my bones, but names will never hurt me. You know, whatever happened to adulthood? Oh, you called me a name? Well, goodness gracious. I'm calling my lawyer. I'm calling Al Sharpton on you, man. 646-6446-646-6446. If you're out of town, 512 is the area code. 512-646-6446. And thanks to that one guy for calling in. Appreciate it. I got this great article here. This is running on antiwar.com today. It's by Paul Campos in the Rocky Mountain News. It's titled, "An Orwellian PR Stunt." Last week, Senator John McCain staged a truly Orwellian publicity stunt in a Baghdad market in a desperate attempt to give some sliver of credence to claims, to his claims, that the dreaded liberal media are failing to report on all the wonderful things happening in Iraq. Oh, by the way, death rate over the last month up another 10%. That's more than 100 dead on average a day in Iraq. Yeah, that's all the wonderful things there. Pardon me. McCain took a brief walk outside the American-maintained fortress that is Baghdad's Green Zone. Afterward, McCain declared his walk through the Sharjah market was a sign that security had improved significantly in the Iraqi capital, and the administration's current troop escalation is working. What he didn't mention was that during his short stroll, he was accompanied by dozens of heavily armed U.S. troops and several armored vehicles, while a couple of attack helicopters hovered overhead. McCain's photo op, which included the spectacle of the elderly senator wearing a flak jacket, was ludicrous on so many levels that even the normally docile national press, which has always treated McCain with kid gloves, pointed out that he was making a fool of himself. Chastened, McCain issued a half-hearted apology a few days later, saying he misspoke when he pointed to his little walk under the protection of several platoons from the world's most powerful military as evidence of Baghdad's excellent shopping opportunities. The most interesting question raised by McCain's pathetic stunt is why this genuine war hero, who after all knows far better than most politicians the difference between real courage and the made-for-TV kind, thought he could get away with it. The answer can be found by taking a random stroll through the archives of the very media McCain was trying to manipulate. From the first days of the Iraq War, it has been an article of dogmatic faith among the movement conservatives McCain is trying to woo that the liberal media have given Americans a far too bleak picture of what's happening in Iraq. Here are just a few examples out of literally hundreds. In September of 2003, former Clinton advisor turned right-wing media pundit Dick Morris declared that the incredibly biased liberal media were claiming, quote, that Iraq is a quagmire, and that there aren't any weapons of mass destruction, and that Bush lied, and that all the while, thanks to Fox News, are seeing with their own eyes how much this is crazy spin. A year later, syndicated columnist and Bush administration stenographer Mark Stein announced that the liberal media were doing their best to hide the fact that, quote, the glass in Iraq is about two-thirds full. The bulk of violence is confined to one province and parts of Baghdad. There is no civil war, says Mark Stein. Last April, President Bush himself took the media to task. The kind of progress that we and the Iraqi people are making in places like Tal Afar is not easy to capture in a short clip on the evening news, he said. He somehow managed to sputter, I guess that's edited for clarity there, that quote. Footage of children playing or shops opening and people resuming their normal lives will never be as dramatic as the footage of an IED explosion or the destruction of a mosque or soldiers and civilians being killed or injured, as though they ever show us that. End quote. The end quote was before the as if they ever show us that. 2 weeks ago, almost exactly a year to the day after Bush uttered these words, Tal Afar was the site of a particularly horrible massacre in which 70 men and boys were lynched. Some of the murderers were members of the town's police force. Huh, just like in America, I guess they are liberated. Over the past 4 years, it's become clear that when it comes to Iraq, perhaps a quarter of Americans are equipped with skulls that can successfully deflect almost all unpleasant facts. These people will account for the majority of the votes cast in next year's Republican primaries. Hence McCain's extraordinarily well-armed stroll. Here's another unpleasant fact. The day after McCain's photo op, 21 people from that same market were kidnapped, taken north of the city, and murdered. As though that isn't all McCain's fault. How do you like that, John McCain, you bloody-handed son of a bitch? When you're not dropping high explosives on people from the air, you're getting your photo op props murdered. Again, quoting from Paul Campos from today's Rocky Mountain News, here's another unpleasant fact. The day after McCain's photo op, 21 people from that same market were kidnapped, taken north of the city, and murdered. Good going, John McCain. You show that liberal media. Just puked in my mouth a little bit. God, I hate John McCain. You know what I'd like to see? I'd like to see Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, John McCain, and Mitt Romney and all these guys in suits covered with razor blades forced to fight each other until there's only one left. And then, you know, somebody should drop the trapdoor on him. I can't believe that this is the pick of presidential candidates we had to deal with. Remember in the year 2000 thinking, oh my God, Bush versus Gore. What are we going to do? We're so doomed. I mean, if it's Gore, we're doomed. And if it's Bush, oh, we're so doomed. Remember that conversation in the year 2000? Now we get to pick between Giuliani and Hillary Clinton? Oh, God. Somebody do something. What the hell? How do we get into this mess? How can it possibly be that the likes of John McCain, who, if I may paraphrase Don Imus, is a stinking animal. How is it that he's a presidential candidate? How could it possibly be that this guy who just got 21 people murdered for his little Saturday Night Live skit is a presidential candidate in the United States of America? How could it possibly be? John McCain, war hero. Yeah, oh, he's a war hero, all right. Yeah, he went right on the radio and told the North Vietnamese that communism was wonderful and told the Americans who could hear him, tuned in on their little headsets, that they ought to quit fighting and read whatever propaganda the communists wanted him to read from his captivity in North Vietnam. What a war hero that John McCain, that propagandist for Ho Chi Minh, when he's not dropping high explosives on innocent people from the air or getting 21 people murdered so that they can be useful props in his photo opportunity. Yeah, he's a real hero, that John McCain. Oh, and I'm sorry, did George Bush say something about Tal Afar is the symbol of American success in Iraq? That the darn liberal media won't tell us the truth about how wonderful things are in Tal Afar? Was that what I just read out of the Rocky Mountain News? Is that what they said? Well, that's funny, because I have this article here from The Independent, Myth of Tal Afar. Beacon of American, ironic quotes, success. And if I could get the darn Independent to finish opening the page for me to where I can read the text of that article, I would be glad to share it with you. But of course, I'm not the boss of the internet. All I can do is click, and basically a click is just a question. Will you please open this article for me? And then the Independent will decide if it wants to or not. Oh, good. Here we are. Oh, good. And it's by Patrick Coburn. Myth of Tal Afar, Beacon of American Success, by Patrick Coburn, published today, April 11, 2007. Pity the city that becomes a symbol of U.S. success in Iraq. Last year, Tal Afar in the northeast of the country was being lauded in Washington as the one place where the U.S. had brought peace. Perhaps the same prescription might work elsewhere in Iraq. Embedded American journalists scurried to this poor and depressing Turkoman city between Mosul and the Syrian border to report on the good news. President Bush even singled it out for optimistic comment in March 2006. Quote, Tal Afar shows that when Iraqis can count on a basic level of safety and security, they can live together peacefully, he said. The people of Tal Afar have shown why spreading liberty and democracy is at the heart of our strategy to defeat the terrorists. It was always a myth. On 27 March, a gigantic truck bomb exploded in a Shia market area in Tal Afar. It was the deadliest single bomb out of the many that have been detonated by Sunni insurgents. The Interior Ministry said that 152 people were killed and 347 wounded in the explosion. Hours after the blast, an event occurred that the Iraqi government had been dreading. The police, all Shia, possibly including some who had lost relatives in the explosion, went on a pogrom. They picked up Sunni men and boys in the street and in their houses and killed them with single shots to the head. As many as 70 may have been executed. Troops from the Iraqi Army 3rd Division were rushed to the town. They were followed by members of Mosul Police Force, who were overwhelmingly Sunni Arab. Some 18 members of the Tal Afar police were arrested and then released. It was always absurd to treat Tal Afar as a possible textbook case of how the U.S. might successfully expedite a counterinsurgency policy. It is a very peculiar city, the only city in Iraq that is almost entirely Turkoman. They, in turn, are divided between a Sunni Turkoman majority and a large Shia Turkoman minority. Under Saddam Hussein, the Sunni had the upper hand. In a poor place with few jobs, they monopolized posts in the army and security forces. After the fall of Saddam, they swiftly joined the insurgency. The insurgents gained control in 2005, only to be routed by American and local Iraqi government forces. But Tal Afar has another peculiarity, a grim-looking place. It has some strategic importance because it is situated on the dividing line between Arab and Kurdish Iraq. The Kurds are eager to control the roads passing through Tal Afar because it leads to Sinjar and is a link to the Kurds across the border in Syria. The American hero of the supposedly successful campaign of 2005 was Colonel H.R. McMaster. Huh, I wonder if he's a different distant relative of mine. The commander of the third Armored Cavalry Regiment. Accounts of his triumph tell once more about the preoccupations of U.S. journalists than it does about Tal Afar and its environs. Colonel McMaster was quoted saying, "You gotta come in with your ears open. You can't come in and start talking. You have to really listen to people." Sadly, these deep insights were not enough to prevent fresh explosions of sectarian violence. In Tal Afar and northern Iraq as a whole, the Iraqi army divisions are mostly, though not entirely, Kurdish. The Kurds are the one community in Iraq that support the occupation. The Shia Turkomans in Tal Afar are also supportive of the government in Baghdad. In the rest of Iraq, the fatal weakness of the U.S. forces is that they have no reliable local allies. So there you go. Tal Afar, the wonderful success story in Iraq, is no such thing at all. Oh, crap, 4 minutes. I can fit in one more here. Oh, two more. Damn, what am I going to do? What do you think, guys? Russia, new Cold War, or 1,000 killed, 125,000 flee, new Somali civil war? Whew. Might have to save that one till tomorrow. That's right, America supported Ethiopia's invasion of Somalia in December. And it's now led to the deaths of thousands of Somalis. All for, if you believe the government and their mouthpieces in the Washington Post and the New York Times, this was all to catch three Al-Qaeda guys. Oh, that's right, yeah. Linked to Al-Qaeda, you understand. These three individuals. That's why America has backed Ethiopia's proxy war against Somalia. That's why thousands of people are dying in Somalia right now. Over 125,000 have been made refugees. It's America's fault. Oh, good. Okay, and so we'll talk about that more tomorrow. That is a headline at the top section of antiwar.com today. It's an article from the BBC. 1,000 killed, 125,000 flee. New Somali civil war. Wonderful. Again, thank you so much, George Bush. You're doing such a great job. And you want to really know about what a great job George Bush is doing, get a load of this. Russia threatening new Cold War over missile defense. Kremlin accuses U.S. of deception on East European interceptor bases. Russia is preparing its own military response to the U.S.'s controversial plans to build a new missile defense system in Eastern Europe, according to Kremlin officials, in a move likely to increase fears of a Cold War-style arms race. The Kremlin is considering active countermeasures in response to Washington's decision to base interceptor missiles and radar installations in Poland and the Czech Republic, a move Russia says will change the world's strategic stability. The Kremlin has not publicly spelt out its plans, but defense experts said its response is likely to include upgrading its nuclear missile arsenal so that it is harder to shoot down, putting more missiles on mobile launchers, and moving its fleet of nuclear submarines to the North Pole, where they are virtually undetectable. Russia could also bring the new U.S. silos within the range of its Iskander missiles, launched potentially from the nearby Russian enclave of Kaliningrad, they add. In an interview with The Guardian, the Kremlin's chief spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said Moscow felt betrayed by the Pentagon move. "We were extremely concerned and disappointed. We were never informed in advance about these plans. It brings tremendous change to the strategic balance in Europe and the world's strategic stability." He added, "We feel ourselves deceived. Potentially, we will have to create alternatives to this, but with low cost and higher efficiency. Any response would be within existing technologies," he said. As well as military countermeasures, Russia's President Vladimir Putin also warned dialogue and negotiations. Also wanted dialogue and negotiations. The Bush administration says the bases are designed to shoot down rogue missiles fired by Iran or North Korea. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Iran has missiles that can reach Poland, don't you know? Oh, yeah, so do the North Koreans. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Oh, geez. Does anybody know geography well enough at all to know how ridiculous that is? Anyway, that's it. I'm all out of time. That's from The Guardian. Russia threatening new Cold War over missile defense. That is, Russia reacting to America's new Cold War against them. And I'm here to tell you, when Pat Buchanan is taking the side of the Russians in the new Cold War, it ain't because he's gone all soft on the Russians. It's because America is the Soviet Union now. And you can read on antiwar.com Pat Buchanan's article, which was a really great article. Let me find the name of it for you here. It was called "Does Putin Not Have a Point?" And that's in the articles, the archives of Pat Buchanan at antiwar.com/Pat. And you can find that article. "Does Putin Not Have a Point?" Pat Buchanan taking Russia's side. It isn't because the Russians are the good guys or because Pat Buchanan is now, you know, soft on the Ruskies. It's because what America is doing is wrong, period. That's why. And because he can see that. That ought to be a clue. That ought to be, you know, a bright, shining clue. And that's it. I'm over time. This is Anti-War Radio, Radio Chaos 95.9 in Austin, Texas. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow talking with Andrew Coburn, author of Rumsfeld, his rise, fall, and catastrophic legacy.
Fucking fear, fucking.